Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome to the Damage Report, everybody. We've got a problem. There is way too much to cover on this episode of the Damage Report, but I'm going to do my best. So here's a brief idea of what you can expect out of this episode. We're going to be starting off with a report from Vanity Fair that talked with a number of people inside of the White House that have been revealing what Donald Trump is actually thinking, saying, and doing behind the scenes in the run-up to these midterm elections. And it turns out very different than what he's implying at his rallies. We're going to be talking about that. We're going to look at a few last-minute polls. We only have like three shows before the midterms. We're going to try to get a little updated idea of what might actually happen next Tuesday. Later on in the show, Bernie Sanders makes the case, laying out the stakes in these midterms, what we're actually up against. We've got an awesome video of Bernie Sanders doing that. Steve King has apparently gone too far for even the Republican Party this time. We'll break down why that is. And we're going to be closing out the show with what might be the most racist ad of my lifetime in terms of politics. It is absolutely horrendous. Donald Trump actually making history, I believe. And so we'll show that to you near the end. So we've got the midterms. We also have two guests joining us. And those guests both have to do with very important environmental issues. We're going to be joined by an expert from The Nation that's going to be breaking down the threat posed by toxic flame retardants in the environment and in our bodies, it turns out. The information he has is absolutely devastating. And later on the show, famed author and environmentalist Bill McKibben is going to be joining the show to talk about climate change, that recent UN report that came out, and what can actually happen in these midterms to help put our country back on the right path when it comes to the climate. But so much to get to, I'm just going to jump right into it. If you listen to Donald Trump at his rallies, he's got this whole midterm thing totally locked down. He's not worried about it. There's going to be a red wave, they say. He's very enthusiastic about all of his candidates. They're totally awesome. And if you go on Twitter and you search on Donald Trump's account, just search, I'll say, Second Amendment. And you will see, I actually, at one point, I screenshotted, I think, 60 tweets that were almost identical of his endorsements of different candidates, where he endorses them all as being awesome on the exact same 5 issues. He doesn't know anything about them. And so his rallies have largely been like that. He goes, and he doesn't so much talk about the individual candidates. He talks about himself and the importance of his supporters supporting him by going out and voting for whatever the Republican candidates might be. And so if you watch all of that, you think, well, he looks like a pretty confident guy. But behind the scenes in the White House, they're apparently a little bit worried. And the last couple of weeks of news, you know, the mail bombs and the synagogue shooting, all of that has really gotten to him, apparently, although he won't say it publicly. So I want to read some of the quotes from this Vanity Fair article. Very interesting stuff. One Republican close to the White House said that he was really upset the momentum had been killed by the pipe bombs. So it's good to know that the pipe bombs actually had an effect on him. You know, he's worried about momentum. Another former White House official in touch with colleagues said that Trump's mood has been grim. The president is self-destructing, the official said. And so in response to him once again entering into one of his black moods, they've been giving him ideas of what he could potentially do over the course of the past few weeks. Now, we've seen how it's actually played out, but here is what they were apparently advising him. To forestall electoral disaster on Tuesday, advisors had been debating strategies for regaining momentum. One idea being discussed, according to a Republican briefed on the conversation, would be for Trump to deliver a primetime Oval Office address on the topic of unity. Trump, however, shot down the notion. And we know how that actually ended up playing out. So he has, since then, mentioned the idea of unity, especially in the immediate aftermath of those mail bomb attempts. He talked about how we need to come together. But in terms of what he's actually doing, going to his rallies, you know, doing his speeches and things like that, that was about as close as he ever came to pushing for actual unity. Instead, he has been pushing us apart, pushing his voters towards fear and hatred of, demonization, especially of the migrant caravan and all of that. And like I said, later on the show, we're going to be showing you one of his political ads, which if you thought there was any chance that he really wanted unity, this is going to make clear how ridiculous that actually is. So they thought perhaps he can, I guess, project this presidential aura, you know, like, yes, I'm kind of crazy and everything, but in a time of political violence and uncertainty in advance of these midterm elections, I'm going to project strength and resilience, constancy from the White House. And he decided to go in a different direction. And in particular, one thing that seems to be frustrating him, according to this Vanity Fair profile of a number of White House aides, is that he really did apparently think that the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation, the battle over it that he helped to frame as a war against the Me Too movement, would be all it took to win these midterms. He really did seem to think that. And they seem convinced that that fight did actually help them, at least in the short term. Now, I'm dubious about what the data actually shows for that, but we're gonna go over it in a second. But now their fear is that it worked, sure, but that they peaked too early. And the initial enthusiasm amongst Republicans as a result of attacking Christine Blasey Ford and other survivors of sexual assault just didn't last long enough. And there's not necessarily enough time to do that again. Maybe Jacob Wall and the whole, you know, the plot to take down Mueller might have given them an opportunity, but that seems to be backfiring. Right now, they're having a press conference in regard to that, and it's, you know, it's an S show. I will put it that way. So in terms of what is likely to happen, he's in this mood. He's campaigning in a particular way. We can see that every day, the way he's talking about birthright citizenship, the way he's talking about the migrant caravan. But we've only got a couple of days until the midterms. And it seems like, based on the combination of those two things, an increasingly hostile and terrible workplace environment in the White House, and the likelihood that things are going to be a lot more difficult in terms of ability to govern after the Democrats likely take control of the House, apparently some White House officials are considering moving on. Perhaps the most high profile is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who is said to be looking for the off-ramp, Vanity Fair says. According to the source, Mnuchin is getting pressure from his wife, Louise Linton, who has been unhappy about her coverage in the media. The source said she's been treated poorly in Washington, and she's like, I want the F out. Although, to be fair, Mnuchin says that is a ridiculous comment. So here's the thing. Maybe it is a ridiculous comment. It seems a little bit ridiculous, but we will know in a month or two. You know, if he ends up leaving, it's not like he's going to have to disavow his previous denials. So maybe Steve Mnuchin will be out. There's also some indication that Kellyanne Conway might finally be looking for an exit. That would be positive because her, you know, every appearance on mainstream media, as you're seeing right there, man, you guys are so quick with the B-roll. It's just it's a steady parade of lies. She adds absolutely nothing, so she can move on and she'll probably get a job at Fox News or something like that. And we also are apparently hearing that the chief of staff position might once again be thrown into, you know, chaos. We don't know who would end up taking that position. Donald Trump had previously said before he got John Kelly that he actually prefers acting as his own chief of staff, which is just a hilarious statement to make. He desperately needs all the help he can get. If Kelly does end up leaving, we don't know who will fill that role. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that it will not be some expert on policy or someone who has a long history of working with the Republicans in the Senate and the House, you know, someone who can help to bring together all the Republicans to get something done. I am guessing it is going to be someone much more explicitly political, you know, possibly a Corey Lewandowski or someone in that mode at the very least. Probably not Steve Bannon considering they're falling out, but somebody who is more of a political hitman as opposed to someone who's going to help him shepherd through legislation and things like that. Now, here's the thing. We're talking about Donald Trump and his terrible mood. It is likely to get a lot worse in the near term because the midterms now are just five days away. Register, vote, all of that. And things aren't looking great. So if we could bring up this next graph, you're going to see the generic congressional ballot over time. This is stretching back through the entirety of this year. And you'll see that there have been variations at various points. You can see around June, the Democrats dropped a little bit. And both have been sort of firming up as people's uncertainty starts to drop away. Both numbers are rising. But there really hasn't been any question through this entire year about what's likely to happen. Now, there is always uncertainty about how the generic congressional ballot actually translates to individual congressional races. You know, so you can't just take this graph right there as gospel. You know, campaigning does matter. The individual dynamics of different congressional districts do matter. But that does not look good. And if I'm guessing that that last dip was probably Kavanaugh, but that was a very brief thing. We're talking about a difference of a couple of days, and then the general trend through the course of the year largely reasserted itself. And you can see that that gap remains very large near the end. We're talking about an average over the course of many polls of still like 7-8 points, with outliers showing even bigger gaps than that. That is enough to scare a president who is actually paying attention to the polls. And he might not be going looking for that information, but he does have aides and advisors around him, and they are seeing these things. Now, something that might be making him feel a little bit better is that in the last few days of these midterm campaigns, the Senate polls are looking a little bit better for Republicans. So if you bring this up, you're gonna see, granted, this is Fox, but they have polled a number of the important battleground states in terms of their Senate races. And you can see that, look, in Arizona, the fact that Martha McSally is actually tied with Kristen Sinema, I would say that that is probably pretty good for the Republicans right now. You have Donnelly there, who's actually up, although honestly, in a number of other polls in Indiana, I've seen that he's been down. Possibly the best result there, honestly, is in Tennessee with Blackburn over, is it Bennison, I believe it is. 9 points at this point, that is gonna be difficult to actually come back on. North Dakota looks like it's done and has been for some time. So honestly, although anything can happen, you know, there could be gigantic turnout, you know, maybe it's not being factored into the polls, people don't understand that independents and young people are voting at higher rates, something like that is certainly possible. But right now, I would not get my hopes up about the Senate. If you're in one of those states, definitely go and vote and get others to do it, but things aren't looking great there. And so maybe that will reassure Donald Trump. I mean, if he could have control of one house, he would probably choose the Senate. It helps to protect him from actually being removed from office. It eases the way to future Supreme Court justices of his choice, things like that. But if the House does go to the Democrats, that is gonna make it harder for him to do what he wants to do day to day. There'll be more investigations. There's a possibility of his tax returns coming out and things like that. And that is certainly going to wear on his mood even more. And here's the thing, it might seem like me focusing on, you know, what he's feeling day in and day out is just, you know, libs like, you know, Schadenfreude or something like that. But I don't think that's actually the case. I mean, Donald Trump in the past week or two has gotten more and more extreme in his talk about nationalism, his fairly open appeals to anti-Semitism and white supremacy. That is an actual, I think, effect of the mood inside of the White House. And it is a consequential one, as we've seen through the mail bombs, and the shooting of the Tree of Life synagogue, and all of that. And if that is combined with things like the deployment of the military to the border, a possible attempt, you know, even if it's ill-fated, to get rid of birthright citizenship, this is not just about his mood, and it's not just about statements. This is about Donald Trump actually acting out in an attempt to regain some measure of control over his situation.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
...as president. And it's only going to get worse if the Democrats do actually get control of the House and possibly the Senate, although it seems less likely. Okay, with that, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, toxic flame retardants. You might not hear a lot about them, but they're pretty damn important, and we'll make clear why after this. Our environment and our bodies are apparently chock full of a toxic substance that most people aren't even consciously aware is out there. Joining the show now to help break it down, Jamie Ligon-Kittman, welcome to the Damage Report.
How do you do?
I'm good, good. Well, except for the toxic flame retardants that are apparently inside of my body and all around this room that I'm in. So I'm glad that you're joining us to help break this down. First of all, toxic flame retardants, how widespread are they in the environment and in our bodies?
Well, they're extremely widespread. It's relatively modern development. Really, beginning in the 1970s, we started getting loaded up with toxic flame retardants. But I would say well, recent studies suggest that 97% of Americans have flame retardant in their systems. And we know that women in every country on the planet have flame retardant in their breast milk. It's turned up too in the blubber of Arctic sea mammals. So it's quite pervasive.
So it's
pretty much every corner of the earth.
Yeah, no matter how far you go, you could actually find it at this point, despite the fact that it's only been used for decades at this point. This isn't something that's been around for literally centuries.
That's correct.
But if this is in our bodies, these substances, what effects can they actually have? Should we be worried?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've been linked to all kinds of cancers. They're carcinogens, but they're also mutagens, meaning that they not only will affect you, but they could affect your offspring. They're particularly dangerous with children, and they've been linked not only to cancers, but to various other problems, but learning disabilities, behavioral disorders, and things of that nature. The worst thing about them, I mean, there's many bad things about them and their history, which is what I've been writing about, but they don't even necessarily prevent fires. And when they do burn, which they ultimately do in a fire, they actually make the fire and the smoke of things burning worse for you than they would otherwise be.
So I'm glad that you brought this up. So this stuff is out there. Presumably, there was initially, I mean, this is used in a lot of places. It's banned now in California, but these have been used very widespread. What are they used for? What is the actual, like, industrial or personal use of these sorts of substances?
Well, there have been flame retardants for a long time. And of course, asbestos was used as a flame retardant. But in the modern wave of flame retardant poisoning, they've been used in all kinds of consumer goods and places that are very close to people's lives and their bodies. For instance, they're in mattresses and furniture, upholstery, cushions and fabrics and clothing and children's bed clothing and pillows, but they're also used in electronic equipment and cars and airplanes and things like that. Ironically, the amounts that they're used in most products, even though they've been mandated by law, are not enough to actually usefully prevent fires. In things like airplanes, they use really heavy amounts of them, and they're a little more useful at protecting flame. However, they're also their impact on the health of people who work in airplanes is significantly greater. People who fly a lot for a living are at risk for very high exposures, and almost uniformly have extra heavy exposures to the flame retardant chemicals.
So with some of the uses that you just listed, I guess it's not really that surprising that some of it ends up leaching into our bodies, especially if we're sleeping on these things, sitting on them, and all of that. How long have we known that these are a problem? I mean, how many decades back have studies been looking into this? Does the industry, have they known for a while that these are harmful substances that are becoming increasingly widespread?
Well, I would say absolutely they knew. The earliest studies were done not long after the first ones were launched in the middle of the 1970s, and they suggested that it was both a carcinogen and a mutagen, and they sort of began a pattern that they've repeated over and over again with flame retardants, which actually harkens back to early environmental pollution, where they would change a molecule here and there and would become a different thing. And they'd say, well, you have to study this again. And then, the laborious process of doing studies on something that people believed was very likely to still be carcinogenic would begin. And then when they were finally concluded, they would change it again. And most recently, they're still selling them. They're under different names and different formulas. And many of them have sort of these appealing, like, Green Chem type of names. That's an actual brand name, which are, likely as bad as everything that came before. Probably one of the biggest, successes has been getting products labeled. And I would counsel people to go out and look, before they buy something to see whether it does contain flame retardant, and specifically request from their merchants that they sell things that they have non-flame retarded options in what they buy.
So you mentioned there the fact that labeling can help at least allow consumers to make, you know, wise choices about the things that they
right.
buy. What other attempts at regulation are going on here in the U.S. in regard to these substances?
Well, many states, 16 states have passed legislation where they undo regulations that they had, mandating them or require labeling and things like that. But at this point, the administration in Washington, the current Congress, are not at all in a hurry to do anything about it, which is not really surprising. So it does continue. And of course, when the heat, no pun intended, started to rise against these in the United States, the companies that sell them redoubled their effort overseas. So you see more and more of it turning up in third world countries and in other nations where the regulations aren't as strict, if you would. It's not really that strict, but they're not as strict as we are. The thing that fascinated me about this story, and I don't know if you want to go there, but the people who make the flame retardant are actually the people who are responsible for what was probably the greatest, scourge of the 20th century, which was the addition of lead to gasoline. And there's a company in Richmond, Virginia, that's known as Albemarle, that bought the rights to make the lead gasoline additive in the early 1960s. And when that started running afoul in the 70s, as they moved to outlaw lead from gasoline, they had a lot of this chemical element bromine, which they had learned to extract in massive quantities in the 1920s and 30s, to use as an additive in lead gasoline. And so they looked around for something to do with bromine. And first they came up with the idea of using it in the exact form that it was used in lead gasoline to work as a grain fumigant, which would, you'd spray it on a crop in a silo and everything, in the place would die, which was great as a pesticide, but it turned out it was a carcinogen. It's very similar to PCBs and DDT, and they outlawed it within the year because it had turned up in breakfast cereals and cake mixes and the like. That's the point that they decided that it had a useful life as a flame retardant, and that's a story right there.
And it seems to me, I'm not an expert, I haven't done the work that you have on this topic. It seems to me that they should just stop putting it in things, like regardless of what the use is. It seems like it's incompatible with human health at this point.
Very true. There's a much better ways of doing these things. I mean, for one thing, the standard that was adopted, ironically, by California Governor Jerry Brown signed the legislation that would be limiting the use of flame retardants in California this year. He also signed the legislation mandating it back in the 1970s. So if you have a long enough political career, you can be on both sides of the issue. And there certainly was a lot of support back then for doing it. People didn't understand the risk. Now I'm forgetting your question. Remind me.
It was basically about that potentially the substance itself should be banned rather than the individual uses of it in a variety of different products.
Absolutely. Most of these substances should be banned, or they should be really tightly regulated and used really only when absolutely necessary. The problem is, as we discovered with lead and gasoline before this, which is still on sale in several countries and used in our propeller planes, even though we know that there are safer and better alternatives, is that there's a deference that this country shows in our courts and our regulatory agents for businesses that are established that might have some very big players involved or wealthy donors. The flame retardant story is, a lot of political influence being bought along the way. Yeah. That once you get started, it's like they're loath to stop you completely. It's like it's just not fair to send somebody home. You have to sort of let them wind it down at their own speed and put enough distance between themselves and the original act, which was when it was clear they knew what they were doing was wrong. They did it anyway, and then it was proven, and then they sort of crab away from it, which is the case with lead gasoline, where the inventors, who were General Motors, and their corporate parents, DuPont, and their partner, Standard Oil of New Jersey, today known as ExxonMobil, they were on notice in the 1920s that lead gasoline was a bad idea. They had letters from the deans of leading medical schools saying, well, we know lead is a poison, and we have for 3,000 years. We don't know how burning it in a car engine could possibly be good for the public health. And they were like, well, you know, you're going to have to prove that. And it was really 40 years before that was done, by which point they were selling out, selling it off to these this little company, Albemarle. And, you know, they've had a over a half century of absolute impunity towards the public health and have not been punished at all. You know, their business has been shrunk sometimes, but then they went into another one. And I think it's very much like, you know, corporations have characters like people do. And if you if you're a bad person for throughout your life, you know, things that are very bad ideas strike you as being acceptable on the risk benefit scale.
And potentially profitable. Well, Jamie, I want to thank you both for your investigative reporting in this area and also for joining us and helping break it down. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Bernie Sanders is giving sort of his closing pitch for the midterms. We're going to show you a bit of that after this. Okay, so we are in the last days before the midterm election, and Bernie Sanders is out there, as he has been pretty much every day for the past almost 2 years, trying to make the case as to why you need to get out there and actually push the country in the right direction. And I think you know at this point that Bernie Sanders is not a guy that minces words. Here is him making it very specific what it is that we're up against.
They are working to make certain that the agenda of the most racist, sexist, homophobic, bigoted president in history will go nowhere because Democrats will control the House and the Senate.
So I might think that he's being a little bit optimistic there about the Senate, but he is an inspirational figure. That is what he does. He gets out there and he gets people inspired to actually change things. But he's very right there that actually, as I said earlier, controlling the House, incredibly important in a number of different areas. And it can help to limit the ability of Donald Trump to turn his stances on things like women, the LGBT community, and things like that, you know, religious minorities, to take it from things that he believes and says to things that actually have an effect in terms of policy. He's still going to be president. He's still going to have his executive orders. He's still going to have his, you know, picks for the Supreme Court. But in terms of mass scale legislation, getting control of even one of those houses will be huge for helping to re-inject some sanity into our country. I also want to thank Bernie Sanders for demonstrating there that this idea that you either do one of two things. You either put forward a positive agenda of economic policies, policies having to do with healthcare and, you know, things like that, or you, you know, directly face what Donald Trump is and what he represents, the misogyny, the anti-Semitism, the homophobia, the Islamophobia and things like that. And Bernie Sanders shows every single day that we got 24 hours every day. We can do both of those things. There is no one who has done a better and more consistent job in providing a positive agenda in basically every area. He really doesn't leave anything out. But at the same time, he showed right there that you can identify what the opposition actually is, what Donald Trump does represent. We do not have to go along calmly allowing for the normalization of absolutely horrendous language and actions. Bernie Sanders is a demonstration of that, and hopefully one that will inspire other candidates going forward to do both of those things. One is certainly not enough considering the magnitude of the challenge that we face. Now, I want to pivot to one other thing having to do with Bernie Sanders, which I think I can confidently say that Bernie probably isn't watching this. He doesn't like this sort of talk. But I am very excited for actually finding out if he is going to run it. Oh, it seems pretty certain at this point that he is going to, but we don't know for sure. But we also might not have to wait much longer. Now, he has said that he is going to announce it at some point. He was asked that recently and said, right now, my focus is on the year 2018. But if you're asking me to make an absolute pledge as to whether I'll be running for president or not, I'm not going to make that pledge. The simple truth is I have not made that decision, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I may not run. I may, but on the other hand, I may not. So look, there he's really trying to have it both ways, but I got news for you. In just a couple of weeks, we might know, because on November 27th, his next book comes out. It's a book called Where We Go From Here, 2 Years in the Resistance. Now, it is possible that that is just going to be a memoir on the past couple of years and some inspirational and policy proposals that people can campaign on. That is possible. It is also possible that that book, which is timed for just a couple of weeks after the midterm elections, is very much going to be a declaration of his intent to run once again for the presidency and what path he will actually take to make that actually happen. I think that at this point, that is pretty likely, and it's for the reason that I've pre-ordered the book. So as soon as I get my hands on it, I'll be reading it and breaking it down for you and all of that. We do have to take another break. When we come back, famed environmentalist and author Bill McKibben is going to be joining the show. We're going to be talking about the latest on climate change and what possible effect these midterms could have on reshaping our climate and environmental destiny in the near future. Very excited to welcome to the show, for the first time, famed environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. Bill, welcome to the Damage Report.
Good to be with you, John.
Good to have you here. I wish we had some good environmental news to talk about, but most of it's been kind of bad, as I'm sure you're aware. There's a number of different things I want to talk to you about. The first, though, is, of course, in just a few days, we do have midterm elections. And I'm curious, these midterm elections, the environment is not one of the topics that's really being focused on, but what potential effect do you think the outcome of these midterms could have on helping to redirect the U.S.'s course on environmental and climate policy?
Actually, you know, I've been out on the road and closing in on a dozen states now, I think. And there's a lot of talk about environmental stuff on the campaign trail. Some of the most important fights aren't about particular candidates. They're over ballot measures. And two to watch are the big fight in Washington State over 1631, which would put a very modest tax on carbon, so modest that even leaders like Bill Gates have come out strongly for it, Proposition 112 in Colorado, which would put a modest setback on fracking so that people can't put an oil well directly next to your house. Both of these were heavily ahead, 70-30 in the polls months ago. But now the oil industry has begun to pour in money in completely unprecedented quantities. They've broken every record in Washington State. They're outspending citizens groups 40-1 in Colorado. And so if these things go down, it'll be in this kind of tsunami of oil money. It's a reminder that if we get a Democratic House, one of the things they need to do is be figuring out how, at the very least, to exercise some oversight over the oil industry, begin to probe why it is that we pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, why it is that we abandoned increases in automobile mileage regulation and methane regulations. Obviously, the House, if the Democrats take control, can't do much by itself, but it can at least raise these issues in a profound way. One of the reasons we're out there campaigning hard.
Yeah, you mentioned there the fuel efficiency standards, and there's been a lot of talk about various changes to that. I've seen recently that even some car companies are coming out and saying that the Trump administration's approach to that is incredibly unwise, self-defeating. Do you think that that is an area that they are going to push through for major changes from the Obama policy?
This is a funny one because the car companies, I mean, be careful what you wish for. The car companies wanted to gut the Obama-era mileage plan, but they didn't want to go quite as crazily far as Trump has gone. And so now they're beginning to get a little nervous about it. Mm-hmm. I think Trump's going to push straight ahead if he can, but I think a Democratic Congress will be able to slow him down, especially since he'd need to be able to override California's special privilege to set its own automobile mileage regulations. I don't think a split Congress would allow him to do that.
Interesting. Okay. Well, maybe a little bit of good news there, a little silver lining. I'm curious, just a few weeks ago, that big UN report came out summarizing some of the recent science on climate change and talking about sort of prospective timelines as to what might happen depending on various forms of international effort to combat climate change. What was your reaction to that report and some of the news coverage around it?
This is the fifth of these big UN IPCC reports that we've had. They've all said essentially the same thing. The biggest difference between this one and the ones that preceded it is that it's 25 years later.
Yeah.
And we've run out of time. We haven't done anything for a quarter century. And so now what would have been a relatively gentle slope that we had to get down has turned into a cliff. hence the note of panic and desperation in those scientists' voices as they issued that report. My sense from being out and around the country is that actually this one sunk in some, and that people are paying attention, in part because it's coincided with our, you know, ever more frequent bouts of hurricane, firestorm, drought, flood, you name it. What was once theoretical and abstract is now very real and everyday for people. And that's why it really is moving up as an issue in people's calculations. The latest data I saw said, A, that young people were voting in far greater numbers in early voting than in the past, and B, that climate change was the number one issue for young voters in America.
I actually had not seen that. That is good news. I'm going to have to look into that more. There was one thing I wanted to ask you about. In terms of some recent lawsuits against environmentalists that have taken action against, for instance, pipelines, there's this concept of the climate necessity defense. Could you explain that?
Sure. People have been engaging in peaceful civil disobedience to try and save block pipelines. There were a group of people just about to go on trial in Minnesota 2 weeks ago for trying to block a pipeline. And some of us were scheduled to go up there and testify as expert witnesses. At the last moment, the judge said that there would be no trial because, in fact, the prosecution had failed to show that they'd done any damage. That was good from the point of view that they don't have to go to jail, and bad from the point of view that what they really wanted was a chance to explain out loud and in public why it's necessary to be taking these kind of steps. We're seeing more and more and more of this as we get closer to the wall. Yesterday in Britain, a group of activists led by the great writer George Monbiot announced a new organization called Extinction Rebellion, and they announced it with a civil disobedience action with 1,000 people blocking traffic in London. Extinction Rebellion is probably a pretty good name for where we are right now.
Yeah. And is it your belief, I know in that particular case they didn't get to actually test it out, but is this an argument that you think various judiciaries in different countries might actually be amenable to?
Increasingly, people have been using this necessity defense. Judges don't usually allow it, but on the occasions when they have, here and abroad, juries have tended to side with plaintiffs and say, yes, it's true, with defendants and say, yes, it's true. You were doing something not for your own gain, not committing a crime in the typical sense of the word. You were trying to prevent greater harm. And that, I think, is true. Civil disobedience is one tool in a large activist toolbox. We don't want to overuse it because, like any tool, it gets dull. But it's really important sometimes to be able to underline the moral urgency of the situation. That's why many of us have spent more time in jail than we would have guessed a decade ago.
Yeah, and a moral urgency and also a pragmatic urgency that, as you point out, the extreme weather events are making more and more obvious with each year that passes.
Good point.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time. Thank you for your work and your activism around these issues.
John, it's a real pleasure. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, one of the last big ads, being pushed by the Republican Party in advance of the midterms, harkens back to some of the darkest, most racist ads in recent history. And we'll be showing you that after this. Donald Trump is closing out his campaigning for the midterms with one of possibly the most racist political ads in recent history. Here it is.
Break up soon, and I'll kill more. See, the only thing that regret is a skill too. I wish I kill more of those motherfuckers. I'll kill more cops soon.
Pedir un perdón.
He says he wants to apply for pardon for the felony he committed. Attempt of murder.
Okay, so there's a lot of issues with that. I mean, one, in terms of me being a person that operates on the internet, one of the things that bothers me the most is that apparently that originated on the Donald subreddit. So the president, who tweeted that out, by the way, that's not some random thing that's going around. The president himself has put his official stamp on that advertisement, if it even qualifies for that term, is trolling around on the darkest corners of the internet for his campaign material. And there he says, that's what he put with the video. It is outrageous what the Democrats are doing to our country. So what the Democrats are doing to our country. So that was Luis Bracamontes. Is he a Democratic official? Is he a registered Democrat? No, he's a random undocumented immigrant that committed a crime. And so apparently the argument here is, if there is an immigrant who has committed a crime, you can't vote for Democrats anymore. Now see, that would be ridiculous enough if we didn't have an instance where multiple hard right wingers had just committed acts of political violence in the past few days in this country. And whether you think that the Tree of Life shooter was directly inspired by Donald Trump's sort of conspiracy theorizing around George Soros and random Jewish billionaires funding immigrant caravans and things like that, there is no disputing that the bombs, the pipe bombs that were mailed around, were sent by a devoted Donald Trump fan. So are we doing ads based around that? Is that what Chuck Schumer is spreading in the last couple of days? They could, and I think it'd be very fair, but they're not doing that. And then on the other side, they find a random murderer and say, it's the Democrats, they did it. So this guy got into the country, the Democrats let him in, what did they open the door? Was it Democrat policies that did that? Donald Trump's been president for almost 2 years. They've controlled the Senate and the House for almost 2 years with a Republican president. And so I have this question to ask to Donald Trump's devoted fans out there. You are terrified right now, right? You're terrified of Luis Bracamontes. You're terrified of the caravan coming. Don't you think it's a little bit weird that you are horrified every second of what's coming over the border, even though you've got Donald Trump who promised to protect you? He's had Republican control of the Senate. He has had Republican control of the House. He's got a conservative majority in the Supreme Court. If years have gone by and you still have to lay awake at night in your bed, terrified of what's coming over the border, maybe Donald Trump isn't actually going to protect you. You think that's a possibility? The Democrats have no power whatsoever. If the Republicans wanted to pass a bill, they could pass a bill, and Donald Trump would, of course, sign the bill. The Republican majority of the Supreme Court would uphold the bill. They could have done any of that yesterday or a week ago or a month ago or a year ago. They didn't do it. Doesn't that seem a little bit weird, considering all of their promises that Donald Trump was the only person who could protect you, that you still have to be terrified of individual undocumented immigrants? So that, I assume, is not going to actually break through. But in a larger sense, the context here is that is an explicitly racist appeal. We've got scary brown people, so vote Republican. That guy, I'm linking a scary minority to the Democrats, so you have to vote for me. Now, we have had racist advertisements in this country for a long time. One of the most famous is the infamous Willie Horton ads, where they attempted to pin the murders of a black man who didn't even go by Willie Horton. They just called him that because it sounds scarier. On a Democratic governor at that time for a furlough program that was actually instituted under a Republican, but facts don't matter. So they had the Willie Horton ads, which were super, super racist, okay? Here's the thing, even then, in what up until this point has been identified as the most racist political ad of its time, they didn't actually spread it themselves, the Republican Party. They pinned it on a third party group that put it out there. They didn't want to be directly associated with that racist advertisements. And even the crazed right-wing activist who put together that ad and helped to fund it and put it out there, on his deathbed, apologized for his involvement in that sort of appeal. You're seeing there a little bit of it there. We are so far past that. The idea that a Republican politician wouldn't want to be affiliated with the advertisement, Donald Trump tweeted it out himself. Some racist ad that he found on the internet now has the official stamp of approval of the president of the United States. In the last days before the midterm, they have nothing left but voter suppression on the one hand and racist appeals on the other hand. That is what they think is enough to get them your vote. The question will be if it actually works, and I am hoping and praying that it does not. Okay, we had more. Unfortunately, we don't have time. We do have one more show to close out the week. Brett Ehrlich is going to be joining me tomorrow. We're going to be doing some last talks about the midterms. We have one more weekend of campaigning. We're going to try to get an idea in some of those high-profile races who might end up winning. We're going to touch base with Beto O'Rourke and a number of others. Thank you for watching the show. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.